Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgain. Project Homeless Connect, an annual one-day event, is an opportunity for homeless and low-income people to access a variety of social services. Janet Darcher is a committee member of Peninsula Poverty Response.
It's kind of a one-stop opportunity for people to come in for an extended period of time to access services as well as tangible goods.
We'll hear about the South Pacific County Project Homeless Connect taking place at the Long Beach Elks on January 29th. Also on the show, how discovery of avian flu in Washington is affecting international trade. Those stories and more just after NPR News headlines next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgain. For the homeless and people without means, accessing social services isn't always possible. When transportation is uncertain, it can be difficult to get to a food bank or keep an appointment with social services or other service providers. Project Homeless Connect is an annual event making services available to homeless and low-income people all in one place, all in one day. This year, the date is Thursday, January 29th. In Clatsop County, it will take place at the Seaside Convention Center. In Washington, an event will take place on the Long Beach Peninsula at the Elks Club at 110 North Pacific Highway in downtown Long Beach. The South Pacific County event is being coordinated by Peninsula Poverty Response. Janet Darcher is Director of Operations for Willapa Behavioral Health in Pacific County and a member of the coalition. Earlier, we talked by phone about the event. Could you start by talking a little bit about the organization? As I understand, Peninsula Poverty Response is fairly new on the scene.
PPR has been pretty active in about the last 2 years as far as coordinating services for homeless and people in that are that are low income, and has really evolved since a year ago when we did our first Project Homeless Connect. Prior to that, there'd been discussions, there'd been the beginning of development for a resource guide, and we've just kind of been able to really do a great job of having within our website a resource guide that individuals in the community can access, providers and people in need. And so that's been highly effective. The Project Homeless Connect, when it came together last year, was quite successful. We had, I believe, over 130 participants, and there were like 100 and maybe 10 volunteers just to assist with that, and I believe there was close to 30 providers, and those providers included everything from haircuts to signing up for the Affordable Care Act to mental health. We had medical screens, we had veterans services, housing, licensing, even daycare. We had bike repair. A vet was there for animals. It was pretty extensive, and it looks like we're going to have the same kinds of services available this year on the 29th at our next Project Homeless Connect.
Oh, well, it sounds like it was a very successful event last year, and you said about 30 providers were involved in last year's event, and you will have similar this year. Can you tell us about some of the providers this year?
This year, we've got dental that we didn't have last year, which is great. The Family Health Center here at Clipson Beach is doing is providing not only a sign-up for the affordable care, but also medical screens and dental screens. We should have eye screening. We don't do any exams. There's just screening. The Department of Health is there for, with vaccinations and blood pressure checks. There's just some of the other services like housing, Department of Licensing, WorkSource, the college, mental health. It's kind of a one-stop opportunity for people to come in for an extended period of time to access services as well as tangible goods. There's clothing, personal hygiene items, and depending on needs, there'll be probably a few other things. As well, again, as we've got a vet that will be there for animals and bike repair, barber. So it's just a real good opportunity. And what we're finding from this is the direction, it's really given us more direction as Peninsula Poverty Response in what we are looking forward to providing, and that's more of a community resource center. We're working a lot with Crisis Support Network. They do the point in time count on that day, but Crisis Supports for Pacific County has oversight of our consolidated homeless grant. And so a lot of the monies that go through, like housing and essential needs, you know, some rapid housing, rehousing monies, they have that money is given to them through the county. And so we're really developing a map of how to access that service, emergency housing, as well as what to do with, you know, making it so it's less a long-term solution to some of the problems.
So it sounds like, in addition to the one-day project Homeless Connect, the Peninsula Poverty Response Committee is involved in the goal of eliminating homelessness, at least on the peninsula. And does the committee or the organization cover the entire Long Beach Peninsula?
Yes, it does. At this point, PPR is just what we consider the South County. It's, you know, Long Beach Peninsula, you know, from Ocean Park south. We are working with agencies in Raymond and South Bend to extend those services.
You said that last year you had 110 volunteers. Are you aiming for a similar number this year?
We'd like to, because what really worked last year was the individualized assistance. As people came in, they did a interview, both from the beginning and then an exit interview to talk about what they got, you know, so that we can fine-tune what we do on an annual basis. And so individuals were, you know, as people came in, they a volunteer was assigned and helped them navigate through the process, identifying what specifically they needed so that they didn't have to go to everything. And it's mapped out. Volunteers are instructed on where to take people. And last year it was a great time to start because the Affordable Care Act was just being implemented. And so with the Medicaid expansion, we were really able to get people in, signed up for service or for Medicaid, and then signed up for services. It was pretty amazing. You know, it just really highlighted the need.
Is there anything else that you would like to add about the event or about the volunteers you're seeking?
The only thing that I would like to make sure that we mention is that if they have any questions, they can go to the website, Peninsula Poverty Response, and they can get some direction from there. Project Homeless Connect will be on the 29th at the Elks Club, and everybody's welcome.
Janet Darcher, thank you so much for talking with us this morning.
Kathleen, thank you, and hope to see you there.
Okay.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Project Homeless Connect will take place in Washington's South Pacific County at the Long Beach Elks, 110 North Pacific Highway in downtown Long Beach, and in Clatsop County at the Seaside Convention Center. The day for both events is Thursday, January 29th. Hours are from 9 a.m. till 4 p.m. at the Long Beach Elks and 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Seaside Convention Center. China is now on the list of countries that have shut down trade for U.S. poultry products after discoveries of avian flu in Washington State and Oregon. Now the U.S. Department of Agriculture and state officials are testing flocks near the latest outbreaks in southeast Washington. Correspondent Anna King reports.
Despite the fanfare of a dozen reporters with cameras, this bantam chicken wasn't too pleased to get its throat swabbed. USDA and Washington state officials teamed up to talk about the work they're doing on farms and backyards around southeast Washington state lately. A local farmer volunteer and her chicken and drake duck were employed to show how birds are swabbed and how to contain the spread of avian flu. Birds started dying suddenly in two flocks here, and then they tested positive for bird flu near the start of the year. Now, every resident in about a two-mile swath around those farms is likely to get a visit from government veterinarians and technicians.
At this ICP, or Incident Command Post, it's 15 people.
That's Rolf Wesley, a USDA vet.
But I have to tell you, we're the people that are out in the trenches, and for all of us that are out there, we have probably two or three as many people behind us, behind the scenes, supporting us so we can do what we can do as quick as we do it.
They've visited farms, neighborhoods, and even several feed stores in the past few days. The bird flu strains found in Washington and Oregon are not harmful to humans, but they are very contagious and deadly among birds. Avian flu is usually carried by wild ducks and spreads from their feces. All of the swabs from these chicken beaks and duck butts will be sent to state and federal labs. If any new cases are confirmed, the quarantine and the circle of search widens, and more USDA boots will land in this wintry desert country. Despite large amounts of public education and news reports, four flock owners from within the quarantine zone have refused to let their birds be swabbed.
This is America, and that's their choice.
Rolf Wesley of the USDA says they may be testing flocks from about 150 homes and farms.
If we can sample 90% of those statistically, I can think we can make the argument that, and we're not finding any disease there. I think statistically you'd make the argument that there is no infection there.
All of this swabbing and door knocking is laborious work. Samples have to be clearly tracked, ag workers have to suit up, don gloves, and sterilize their boots and baths with large brushes. Even truck tires have to be disinfected between stops. And this work is critical to a U.S. industry that exports hundreds of millions of dollars worth of chicken and eggs. Just in 2013, about 280,000 metric tons of chicken were shipped to China alone. Jim Sumner is the president of the United States Poultry and Egg Export Council.
This is just horrendous.
He says now that several key countries have cracked down on U.S. chickens and eggs at ports, it could take years to get those markets back.
Countries are going to have to come to the realization that migratory bird patterns are going to spread certain diseases and that they can be controlled, and that just because a migratory bird or even a backyard flock test positive for something like high path avian influenza does not mean that it's in the commercial poultry industry.
Back in southeast Washington at the press event, government officials say it's important for backyard chicken and duck owners to keep their fowl separated from wild birds. So far, no commercial chicken farms have reported illness in their flocks. I'm Anna King in Richland, Washington.
Supporters of a trio of agreements meant to settle the rancorous water disputes in the Klamath Basin are gearing up to take another run at getting congressional approval for the deal. A Klamath bill by Oregon's Democratic senators was not included in a massive funding measure passed in the frantic final hours of the last Congress, now amid signs that support for the agreements is growing. From Jefferson Public Radio, Liam Moriarty reports that the spotlight is turning towards the region's Republican congressmember.
The failure of the Senate bill that would have implemented the Klamath water agreements left a big question mark. What would happen now? Among stakeholders in the region, the answer was largely that somehow or another, the deal would move forward.
Of course we're going forward.
Glenn Spain is with the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, a commercial fishing group.
There is no alternative on the table other than going back to the kind of chaos we saw a decade ago.
Farmers and ranchers in the Klamath have waged a long and bitter battle with fishermen and Indian tribes over the region's scarce water, with periodic irrigation water shutoffs and fish die-offs raising the stakes. Over the course of years, the three water agreements were hammered out as the various stakeholders eventually negotiated compromises most felt they could live with. One federal official said what finally brought everyone to the table was the realization that part of something is better than all of nothing. Now, with three interlocking agreements awaiting congressional approval, stakeholders say it's crucial to wrap it up.
This is how we're going to have stability and resource management in the Klamath Basin as we move forward.
Greg Addington heads the Klamath Water Users Association, which represents farmers and ranchers on the federal Klamath Irrigation Project. Addington says at this point, making major changes in the deal isn't feasible.
As you look at the complexity of these issues and the work that went into crafting these agreements, really over the last 8 or 9 years, we've been at this for a while, and it just makes you more confident that you've really crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's and looked at all the potential solutions.
In recent months, a growing number of previously skeptical groups have come to back the water deal, including the Klamath Falls City Council, the Klamath County Chamber of Commerce, and the Klamath Cattlemen's Association. One key player who hasn't yet signed on is Republican Congressman Greg Walden. The Klamath is in Walden's district, and so far he's had reservations about the agreements, in particular the part that would remove the four hydropower dams on the Klamath River. The dams have blocked fish passage for more than 50 years. As more Klamath agriculture groups have swung their support to the deal, they've urged Walden to get behind it. But if Walden hopes to substantially change the dam removal part of the deal, Don Gentry, who chairs the Klamath Tribal Council, would beg to differ.
It's pretty clear that the parties are all on board. That's part of the package, and without that dam removal component, the agreements will unravel.
Gentry says removing the dams is crucial to restoring the endangered fish populations the tribes have a treaty right to. Just as the new session of the U.S. Senate convened this month, Oregon Democrats Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley reintroduced their Klamath water bill that died last session. Merkley says with the probability of another dry summer approaching, time is running out.
This has to happen in legislation to lock in the components as a group. And so we could have a major water war or water catastrophe, however you want to put it, for the ranching farming community if we don't get this done.
While there are still parties opposing the agreements, the Klamath County Commission and the Hoopa Indian Tribe among them, the success of this effort would seem to hinge on Greg Walden's support. Walden's office declined to comment except to say he's been meeting with stakeholders and, quote, shares a common goal of finding a viable path forward. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgain. Still ahead, the largest oil-by-rail shipping terminal in the United States could be sited along the banks of the Columbia if the Vancouver Energy Project comes to fruition. General Manager Jared Larrabee says it would generate local jobs.
It would have the ability to handle 360,000 barrels a day, which would be about four trains a day. That we could handle at the facility, and to bring those in, unload the trains, put the crude oil into tanks, and from there put it onto ships to ship to the West Coast refineries.
Conrad Wilson talks with the project's friends and foes. That story coming up right after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Cloudy today, patchy fog throughout the day with high temperatures in the low 40s, east winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, rain likely early this evening, more rain overnight with overnight lows in the high 30s to low 40s. Continued east winds 5 to 10 miles per hour, chance of precipitation tonight 80%. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says a tropical moisture tap will bring rain heavy at times this evening into tomorrow, giving us about 1 to 3 inches of rain. We'll also see some gusty winds with the system, gusting to 30 miles per hour tonight, possibly up to 50 along the beaches. This is a relatively fast-moving system. We'll likely see between 1 to 3 inches of rain with the system through tomorrow. For the weekend, it still looks wet, with another disturbance later Saturday into Sunday. More lingering scattered showers are expected Monday, diminishing some on Tuesday. An oil company wants to build the largest oil-by-rail terminal in the country on the banks of the Columbia River. The Vancouver Energy Project would ship oil daily from the Port of Vancouver, Washington, to refineries along the West Coast. The companies backing the project promised jobs, but as Conrad Wilson reports, some of the neighbors are worried.
Linda Garcia drives along the streets of the Fruit Valley neighborhood in Vancouver, Washington. For almost the last 20 years, it's the place she's called home.
My neighborhood is my family.
But she's concerned about how this working-class transitional neighborhood, those are her words, could change for the worse if the Vancouver Energy Project builds the nation's largest oil-by-rail terminal at the Port of Vancouver. Many of the homes in the neighborhood, along with an elementary school, are less than a mile from where as many as 4 trains filled with crude oil would unload at the port every day.
If there were any type of incident, explosion, over-release of chemicals, spill, earthquake, anything that will cause a safety issue, we're not entirely convinced that our neighborhood will be safe from that.
Not only that, but documents filed in August by the Vancouver Energy Project with the state show the proposed terminal would emit chemicals known to cause cancer. However, according to the documents, those emissions would be in line with the state's air pollution regulations. Garcia says the community has long had a positive relationship with companies at the port. And for the most part, she says, the neighborhood has embraced industry as part of daily life. The small uniform houses in Fruit Valley are evidence of that relationship. Many were built during the early 1940s to house employees who worked at the Kaiser shipyards during World War II. Despite that history with industry, Garcia says last year the Fruit Valley Neighborhood Association voted to oppose the oil terminal.
So many companies have come into the port and have told us their plans. And if we have any concerns, every single one of those concerns has been addressed.
Garcia says that while the project's backers did come to a neighborhood meeting, residents are still worried about safety. Not far from Fruit Valley, Barry Kane is showing a video of plans for the city's new blockbuster development.
We did this a few years ago just to give people, you know, the idea of what it is we were proposing.
Sitting behind a desk in the spacious lobby of City Hall, Kane whips out his iPad to show off a rendering of a massive 32-acre, $1.5 billion mixed-use project right on the Columbia River.
We've got a half-mile-long park, and we'll have great restaurants. It'll be just a beautiful environment.
Kane is president of Graymore Development. While the project's not too far from Fruit Valley, if the sleek design is any indication, the two neighborhoods are worlds away. Still, like many of the residents of Fruit Valley, Kane doesn't want to see the oil terminal built. The 21-block development is sandwiched between the Columbia River and the very railroad tracks that would carry crude oil to the port.
We're fighting it because, you know, there's no benefit to us.
It's a great benefit to the area.
Jared Larrabee is the general manager for the Vancouver Energy Project. He says the proposed oil terminal will create 320 construction jobs and an estimated 176 additional jobs once it's up and running.
It would have the ability to handle 360,000 barrels a day, which would be about 4 trains a day that we could handle at the facility, and to bring those in, unload the trains, put the crude oil into tanks, and from there put it onto ships to ship to the West Coast refineries.
He says safety will be integral to the oil terminal.
This is a facility designed from the ground up specifically to handle this and specifically for this type of operation. So what that means is we can design all the state-of-the-art safety features in right from the get-go.
The oil terminal is under review by the state's Energy Siting Council. Ultimately, the council will make a recommendation to Governor Jay Inslee, who will decide whether the project moves forward. I'm Conrad Wilson in Vancouver, Washington.
That's all the time we have for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you join the show late, you can listen to a podcast of the show from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments on the show. Call us at 503 325-0010 or email to news1, that's NEWS, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgane saying thank you for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.